It is much safer to be feared than loved. Love is preserved by the link of obligation, which, owing to the baseness of men, is broken at every opportunity for their advantage. But fear preserves you by a dread of punishment which never fails. Niccolo Machiavelli in The Prince.
So this is how liberty dies.
Welcome to Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause. I'm your host, Scott, with Uncle Ian. Today's matchup features two South American dictators, Augusto Pinochet up against Jorge Videla. Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause is a history podcast obsessed with history's biggest dictators. We've created a knockout competition to determine the single most significant dictator of all time. Each episode features a matchup of two dictators where we discuss the life and times of each leader. The loser of each battle is eliminated from the tournament. The winner remains in the contest to be named history's biggest dictator. Let's talk about Augusto Pinochet first. Pinochet ruled Chile from 1973 to 1990. Augusto Pinochet was born on the 25th of November, 1915. He was the son of a customs official, a bit of a mummy's boy. His father called him a weak lad. He was rejected from the military twice. His mum pushed him to go again, and he eventually succeeded in entering the military. He had a very unremarkable time at the academy. From 1937 onwards, he climbed the ranks of the military and succeeding in his postings without really impressing anyone or making a name for himself. The only noteworthy event in Pinochet's military career occurred in 1948 while commanding a prison camp for arrested communists. He met the future socialist prime minister of Chile, when the then senator, Salvador Allende. At the time, Allende was a young socialist senator who came to visit the prisoners. The then Lieutenant Pinochet threatened to shoot him if he tried to enter the prison camp. In 1970, that same senator became Prime Minister of Chile. His socialist party won 36% of the vote, which we call a plurality. So there was multiple right-wing parties. Their vote was split. And Allende's Socialist Party, they won the election with 36%. Allende's time was not successful. He instituted high tariffs, which meant there was no international trade. The major economic issue was that he nationalized all the industries. They had some success early on, but nationalizing the economy led to all the businessmen fleeing the country. Profit motive was reduced, which led to inefficiency. The competent business people were slowly replaced by less competent civil servants. Production declined, and their economic system could not generate any prosperity to share around, so they ran out of other people's money. By 1972, food lines sprung up in the capital. Throughout this time, Pinochet is still in the military, making his way up the hierarchy. On the 8th of June, 1971, following the assassination of right-wing politician Edmundo Zujovic by left-wing radicals, Allende appointed Pinochet a supreme authority of Santiago Province, Santiago being the capital of Chile. Allende remembered being threatened at the camp by someone, but misremembered the incident and attributed it to another army official. So Pinochet got very lucky because he's just been promoted by the man he once threatened to shoot. Pinochet was a loyal officer. He even led the crackdown against the anti-Allende protesters. Pinochet didn't take part in the first coup attempt. That attempt was snuffed out by General Carlos Prats, the head of the military. When Carlos Prats resigned, Pinochet was named head of the military. Pinochet is so underestimated that when he told his wife the news that he'd been promoted, Mrs. Pinochet thought he was joking. He was promoted because he was the only military man seen as loyal to the government. This belief was misguided. On September 11, 1973, less than 3 weeks later, Pinochet and his military junta ousted Marxist President Salvador Allende. 3 days before the coup, he was given an ultimatum by the commanders-in-chief of the Navy and Air Force to join them or suffer the consequences. These generals later said that Pinochet was considered untrustworthy and played no role in the coup. Pinochet was an unimpressive and seemingly unambitious man. The president believed him to be loyal. when the coup started, the president said, "I wonder what they've done with Paul Pinochet." Paul Pinochet was leading the takeover of Chile, rounding up thousands of political opponents into the football stadium to be killed, and talking about flying the president out of the country and crashing the plane somewhere along the way. His justification for such an act was, quote, "Kill the bitch and you finish the spawn." By the end of the coup, Allende had killed himself with a gun given him to him by Fidel Castro. How about that? Fidel Castro being the dictator of Cuba. The junta later claimed that they had to seize power because the president was planning a self-coup to end democracy and become a communist dictator. This was a lie. Contrary to popular belief, though, America was not involved in the coup. However, it did fund media outlets critical of the government, helping to turn public opinion. The Chilean people were delighted with the coup, not just because it's fun to say the word junta. The economic decline was harshly felt. The American propaganda effectively soured the public's opinion of the socialist president. Pinochet had power land in his lap, and he didn't miss the opportunity. There were plans for a rotating presidency between the four members of the ruling junta of service chiefs. These plans were dropped, and Pinochet was named President of the Republic. A cult of personality was built around Augusto Pinochet.
Prior to him being named president, he'd had a number of titles to his credit. After being commander-in-chief of the army, he had taken his turn as chairman of the ruling junta. And in June of 1974, so that's the year following the coup, he assumed the title of Supreme Chief of the Nation before elbowing his colleagues out of the way to taking the presidency for himself.
Pinochet has his hair slicked back, wearing a military uniform with a red sash and a plate-sized gold medal. He was famous for his scowl and sinister dark glasses. He transformed his image from mild-mannered, unimpressive man to serious, scary dictator. He was reported to enjoy the special protection of the Virgin Mary, and statues of Pinochet appeared around the country. The cult of personality concentrated all power to him and his civilian advisors and away from the military. A ruthless secret police watched the regime as much as they watched the opposition. Pinochet had become a fully fledged dictator. In 1975, he declared, "I am going to die. The person who succeeds me will also die, but elections you won't have." That was also the year, in 1975, in which he attended Franco's funeral. He was the only head of state to do so. Pinochet gave his rule some legitimacy by winning the 1980 plebiscite that approved a new constitution with himself as president. Investigations into the vote have found it to have many irregularities, they call it. There were electorates from which Pinochet received more votes than people. Oh, God. For the most part, the basis of his plebiscite victory was the state of the economy. As you've heard, Allende's socialist policies had not been successful. Pinochet hired the Chicago Boys, who ran the economy according to Milton Friedman's free market capitalism. With political parties and trade unions banned, the Chicago Boys set about radically remaking the state-controlled economy. So this was achieved through wholesale privatization and opening up to the international economy. Pinochet says, "The nation is trying to make Chile a country of proprietors, not of proletarians." I really like that as a quote. It's quite effective. It sums up the difference between his right-wing ideology and the left-wing ideology. Unis were purged of arts degrees and leftist ideologies. They only taught technical skills, engineering and medicine. It's safe to say that the University of Santiago was not offering bachelor degrees in lesbian dance theory.
Nor basket weaving, Scott?
No basket weaving. All that stuff out of the question. Chile became a byword for economic success. It was called the Miracle of Chile. The gap between rich and poor did widen, as you'd expect. The policies resulted in the average annual economic growth of 7%, three times over the Latin American average. And there's an excellent photo taken at Madame Tussauds Wax Statue Museum. Pinochet standing next to the statue of Vladimir Lenin, and he's waving his finger at Lenin saying, "You were wrong." A couple of dictators next to each other, one's a statue, arguing over economic policy.
I would have believed Pinochet a bit more if he'd actually gone to Moscow and waved his finger at Lenin's mausoleum.
Good luck with that one. Oh, so let's talk about the murders. There's a lot to discuss here. It's not all economic growth, I'll tell you what. Enemies within the military were retired or went missing. In 1974, even the aforementioned General Prats became one of the victims. He and his wife were killed in exile in Argentina by a bomb attached to their car. It was truly state terrorism. Approximately 3,000 people were killed during Pinochet's rule, mostly suspected Marxists. These people seemed to vanish into thin air. Some were taken on planes and thrown out to sea or dumped in mass graves. Death caravans roamed the streets and discreetly captured their victims. It was specific, targeted killings. Not like none of this mass slaughter that you get in other countries. Very deliberate acts. Family members were not even told why their loved ones had been killed or where they were buried. There were instances of political opponents being shot in front of their family. I have a quote from a lady talking about her family member who was killed. "They shot him on the road near our house. I heard the shots and I came out and found his body. They yelled at me to go and bury the dog that had just been killed. That dog was my only son. They gave me 3 hours to bury him and get out of town. I had to wrap him up in a blanket, get an ox cart and leave him in the cemetery." Many were not even told that their child had been killed and waited with false hope for them to return. Another lady says, "For 2 years, I hurried home from work to see if he had returned. On windy nights, my mother thought the creak in the door was him. She used to get up to let him in, and then she would weep." Not even fleeing Chile guaranteed your safety. In 1976, Allende's former Foreign Secretary, Orlando Letelier, and his American secretary were blown up by a car bomb in Washington, D.C. Mate, that's ballsy. Pinochet was the driving force in this brutality. In a 1981 speech, he declares, "Not a single leaf moves in this country if I'm not the one moving it. I want that to be clear." That's fantastic stuff. He also was a driving force in Operation Condor, and we'll hear more about that later when we go to Argentina. Tens of thousands of people were tortured in Chile. There was the famous Villa Grimaldi, which is the most famous site, but there are many other sites similar to this. A lot of different torture styles. Sometimes it would consist of solitary confinement, basically the size of closets, which the person had to remain in, standing in this tight space for days. Electric shock was the most common form of torture. Agents would tie naked prisoners to a bed and attach shock devices to their sensitive parts of their body, such as the lips or genitals. Detainees were sometimes drugged. Rape was widely used for women, but also for men. The report of the Chilean National Commission on Truth and Reconciliation state, torture methods were extremely varied. An almost universal technique was violent and continual beating until blood flowed and bones were broken. Another form was to make detention conditions so harsh that they themselves constituted torture. For example, keeping prisoners lying face down on the ground or keeping them standing straight rigid for many hours, keeping them many hours or days naked under constant light, or the opposite, unable to see because of blindfold or hoods, or tied up, keeping them in cubicles so narrow, sometimes made just for this purpose, that they were unable to move, holding them in solitary confinement along with one or more of these conditions, denying them food or water or clothing or sanitary facilities. It was also common to hang prisoners by their arms with their feet off the ground for long periods of time. They might be held under water, foul-smelling substances, or excrement to the brink of suffocation. There are many accusations of sexual degradation and rape. A common practice was a simulated firing squad. In some places, torturers used highly developed torturers, such as the practice in which a person is hung, head hanging down by a pole or stick placed beneath the legs and arms, and mistreating prisoners in front of their relatives or vice versa. The families of the victims made statements at this commission. One said, "I had searched for him for so much. I went down to the beach to cry, and there he was, all swollen with bullet wounds. They had pulled out his teeth." Another recounts, "When they took my father, they took my husband and me as well. I was raped by a whole group that was guarding me. I never told my husband." Another says, "They told me he smoked his last cigarette in handcuffs. He was trembling and couldn't inhale. That's the image that keeps me from dying in peace." Torture was often conducted in the presence of family members, one saying, "While they were raping me, my husband was screaming at them to let me go." an estimated 80,000 Chileans were interred, and an estimated 200,000 to 1 million Chileans went into exile. Bit of corruption. Lighten the mood. Everyone loves a bit of corruption. Some of the government properties were sold below market prices to politically connected buyers, including Pinochet's own son-in-law. And when they got all this state-owned apparatus, then they start selling that off at low, low prices to his family members. There was a bit of censorship as well of immoral movies to appeal to the Catholic base. And his fortune grew considerably during his years in power through dozens of bank accounts secretly held abroad and with a fortune of real estate. He corruptly amassed at least $28 million. With all this, no awards from the UN. In 1986, he said, "My library is filled with UN condemnations." In September of 1986, the FPMR Marxist group ambushed Pinochet with stolen weapons. His military bodyguard was taken by surprise and five members were killed. Pinochet's bulletproof Mercedes-Benz vehicle was struck by a rocket but didn't explode. Pinochet and his grandson, who was also in the car, both survived. And then the Pope came to town.
Yes, in 1987, Catholic Pope John Paul II visited Chile, which helped focus international attention on the conditions under which the Chilean people were living. And given that there was a referendum due, because the first referendum had been set out in the 1980 Constitution that it had to happen after 8 years, the yes-no referendum, and the Pope's visit just happened to be the year before that.
In that 1988 plebiscite, 56% voted against Pinochet staying on as president. This led to democratic elections for the presidency and for Congress. He wasn't too happy with the result, old Augusto Pinochet. He said, "Don't forget that in the history of the world, there was a plebiscite in which Christ and Barabbas were being judged, and the people chose Barabbas." That is fantastic stuff.
He's not trying to put himself on any sort of pedestal there, is he?
I like that. That's very well played. Just to fill in the non-Christians here. They gave the people the chance to save Jesus or this Barabbas bloke. This Barabbas bloke was a criminal. They chose to save Barabbas. Pinochet stepped down in 1990. He continued to serve as commander-in-chief of the Chilean army. That's until the 10th of March 1998, after which he became a lifelong senator.
The clever thing about his appointment as senator for life was that it carried with it immunity from prosecution.
However, he was arrested. He liked to go to London. As we mentioned, he goes to Madame Tussauds. He absolutely loved Madame Tussauds. He's obsessed with it. I don't understand why. Maybe it's just so he can wag his finger at Lenin. I don't know. He goes to London and he's arrested because the Spanish have an arrest warrant for him because he's killed a lot of Spanish citizens living in Chile. So he's arrested and they're going to extradite him to Spain. But his health is failing. So Tony Blair, the Labour Prime Minister, Labour Home Secretary Jack Straw, frees Pinochet due to his poor health. Margaret Thatcher, the ex-Conservative Prime Minister, sends him a bottle of scotch with a note saying, "Scotch is the one British institution that will never let you down." Look, she's correct there, but she shouldn't have done that.
It goes back to the Falklands War. We'll hear a little bit about the Falklands War separately, but in 1982, Chile was technically neutral during the Falklands War between Argentina and Britain. However, Chile kept its border patrols, which meant Argentina had to deploy its own troops on the Chilean border and therefore couldn't deploy all of its troops to the Falklands. There are also reports that Chile provided military intelligence and also radar observations to the British to help them during the Falklands War, so Thatcher was very grateful for that.
Pinochet is sent back to Chile, doesn't face any legal action in Spain. He never expressed any remorse for the horrors inflicted on his own people. In 1991, he was asked about the burial of 125 political opponents in 108 graves, and he replied, "How very economical." Chile did file charges against Pinochet, but he died on the 10th of December 2006 with 300 criminal charges outstanding against him. These were for numerous human rights violations during his 17-year rule, as well as tax evasion and embezzlement. The head of the aforementioned Villa Grimaldi during the Pinochet dictatorship, that was Marcelo Morin Brito, He was later convicted of crimes against humanity, and he was sentenced to more than 300 years in prison. The legacy of Pinochet. Quick question, Uncle Ian. Was he a fascist?
My answer would be no. He was one of those military strongmen that... But I think when you look at some of the fascist dictators we've already met and some of those we haven't met yet, no, I don't think he'd rate.
Funnily enough, he's not considered fascist partly because he's too right-wing. Typically, fascism involves some state involvement in business. There was none of that. It was completely free market. And also, nationalism was present, but it didn't have the ethnic identity component that fascism usually has.
Part of the reason for that might have been Pinochet's own background. He was of French, Breton and Basque background, so not traditionally Spanish background. So that meant that he wouldn't be looking at it from a racist point of view. It was just more from a political standpoint that he chose his victims.
And the communists gave him a scapegoat, someone to blame for the country's problems. He didn't need to pin it on some sort of ethnic minority. Legacy of Pinochet is also complicated by the economic success. A recent United Nations study of life expectancy, salaries, healthcare, and education rated Chile as the highest in Latin America. It also has the region's largest middle class. It also has one of the largest gaps between rich and poor. The New Yorker described him as the rarest thing of all, a successful former dictator.
I don't think we've said that so far in the series.
Chilean opinion polls show that roughly a quarter of his citizens revere Pinochet. That's a lot. With Cuba, they were so aggressively anti-communist, they were willing to tolerate almost anything from a right-wing government. It's time to introduce the dictator up against Augusto Pinochet, the Argentinian Jorge Videla. Uncle Ian, please talk us about Jorge.
Videla was born in the province of Mercedes in 1925. Had a military background. He was the son of a colonel. His great-great-grandfather had fought in the Spanish-American Wars of Independence. His grandfather was a provincial governor. It was no surprise that in his teens he went to military college and was able to rise through the ranks. He married in 1948, seven children. By 1971, he was a brigadier general, director of the National Military College, and by 1975, Perón had appointed him general commander of the army. There are several Perons in the Argentinian story, so let's have a quick look at the Perón family. Juan Perón had served a number of terms as president since shortly after the Second World War. He'd been sometimes sent into exile, had returned in 1973 to become president, but then Juan Perón died in July of 1974. We've all heard of Eva Perón, who was his second wife. She died in 1952 and subsequently had songs and musicals written about her. In July of 1974, Juan Perón's vice president was his third wife, Isabel. We heard in the last episode about Gucci Grace. She did not manage to succeed her husband as president and dictator, but Isabel Perón did. So she became president upon the death of Juan in July of 1974. Her presidency was fairly short-lived. The prime mover of the coup was the state of the Argentinian economy. The economy was actually collapsing. There was soaring inflation. Everything was being ruled by the black market. There were shortages of all sorts of goods. And story starts to overlap a little bit with the story in Chile. There was a military coup led by the senior officers of all three military services to set up a military junta. The one difference from the outgoing president's perspective is that she was placed under house arrest and then sent into exile in Spain.
There was also a bit of a power vacuum. Isabel, towards the end of her time, she gave up on running the place, and there were left-wing terrorists and right-wing terrorists killing each other in the street. There was a feeling in the country that someone had to take control and do something because the president wasn't doing anything. The junta stepped into this power vacuum to create order.
In 1976, after the coup, parts of Argentina went into civil war, and the military junta launched the national reorganization process. I've got a little note here that it probably sounds a bit grander in Spanish. The process was primarily against the left-wingers, and this was the start of what became known even by Videla himself as the Dirty War. The Dirty War flowed on from the existence of the AAA squad that had been set up under Isabel Perón as a death squad to get rid of enemies. By 1977, Videla had survived three assassination attempts, so the people were very early realizing what they'd landed with. At least 15,000 and possibly as many as 30,000 Argentinians disappeared, and that was the actual word that was used about their fate. Disappearance meant many things. We've already heard that it was a feature of the Chilean regime to put your political rivals into an airplane, fly it over the ocean. The evidence shows that at least 4,000 opponents of the Argentinian junta suffered that fate, to be thrown into the Atlantic from military planes, drugged up and naked. This regime also abducted thousands of children from its enemies so that they'd be given to childless military leaders. Clandestine detention camps, as many as 340, were set up across Argentina to hold captive the enemies of the regime. It was also an anti-Semitic regime. Up to 3,000 Jews were captured by the regime, put into some of these detention camps, and in those camps there were Nazi posters. This regime also harboured refugees from Nazi Germany that were still escaping justice more than 30 years after the Second World War.
And Uncle Ian isn't talking about refugees fleeing the Nazis. He's talking about the Nazis who are fleeing the consequences of their actions after the Second World War.
Now, the junta justified this by saying that the disappearances and the death squads had been a feature of Isabel Perón's presidency. And that's true, but the junta made this a more strong course of action. The United States had a part to play in all of this. The junta was very much identified as being right-wing, and 2 months prior to the coup, the United States was aware that the junta was going to try to take power. They were comfortable with that because the Peróns had been from the left, and this is the same US that had watched a Marxist get elected in Chile only a few years earlier, so they were pretty paranoid about the thought of that happening in Argentina. And of course, this is the same US that was, quite frankly, embarrassed by the fact that Castro was still in power on the US doorstep despite the CIA's best efforts. The US managed to find $50 million in military aid to the Argentinian regime. They did that in various ways. One of the more nefarious of those ways was Operation Condor. It was a US-backed enterprise in support of right-wing dictatorships in the southern half of South America. Chile, Argentina, Bolivia, Uruguay, Paraguay, Brazil, Peru dabbled in Operation Condor for a little while. The CIA's perspective on this was that Operation Condor was a cooperative effort by the intelligence and security services of the South American countries to combat terrorism and subversion. The victims of Operation Condor in all of the countries I've named, union leaders, priests and nuns, anyone who was going to be labelled a dissident, students, guerrillas, leftists in general, mothers of the stolen children, all of them were targets of the regime. Victims being thrown into the ocean, there were countless stories of bodies being washed up upon the beaches. The tally of Operation Condor across all the countries, killed and disappeared, somewhere between 60,000 and 80,000, put into prison some 400,000 victims of Operation Condor to be tortured, to be tried to be brainwashed, and to have their families threatened. The US provided military intelligence, training, telecommunications equipment, financial assistance, advanced tracking technology. The US Secretary of State under Nixon and Ford, so up until January 1977, was Henry Kissinger. In October 1976, a few months after the junta took power, Kissinger told the Argentinian foreign minister, quote, "We would like you to succeed, but the quicker you succeed, the better." Now, Kissinger said that the month before the election where Carter beat Ford. Kissinger would have been well aware that Carter was a Democrat, that he would have been less inclined to continue to support Operation Condor. One of the last acts by the Clinton regime, so that's in the late 90s, was to release documents that show that Kissinger was aware and gave tacit support to Operation Condor. In 1978, Argentina hosted the Football World Cup. Videla was president of Argentina at the time. Remember, some of these countries are harbouring Nazi war criminals. They're harbouring drug lords. Kissinger was an ex-Secretary of State at the time, but he was Videla's guest at the 1978 Football World Cup.
Very friendly, the two of them. I think they had some ideas in common, unfortunately.
Sadly, yes.
A bit of Pope action in Chile. There's also a bit of Pope action in Argentina. The current Pope, Pope Francis, he is an Argentinian, and he was a priest during this time, and he's been accused of wrongdoing during this time in Argentina. Some people say that he collaborated with the regime. I don't believe that's actually true. It's probably fair to say he wasn't as courageous in speaking out as many of the other priests at the time. He did meet with Videla. He basically begged Videla to release some of the Jesuit priests who had been speaking out against the regime.
I think he was the wrong place at the wrong time. It's important to stress that the now Pope Francis was not yet an archbishop at the time that Videla was the dictator, so his influence was only ever going to be limited, by no means an apologist for him, but there are certain stories that there were some victims of the regime he was able to shelter and help them to flee the country. However, I think he was in a position where any influence he was going to have was only ever going to be limited. And the now Pope Francis, also a Jorge, coincidentally.
I assume there's a few Jorges in Argentina.
Yeah, apparently it's a bit like being Gaius in ancient Rome.
I thought you were going to say George. He's gone for ancient Rome. Very good.
That's where we started.
No, you're right. You're right.
Perhaps fortunately for the Argentinians, Videla's regime didn't last as long as Pinochet's. By 1981, now Videla's only 55 at the time this happened, which as far as I'm concerned is still relatively young. Videla transferred power to one of his fellow generals, and the Argentinian government went through 5 presidents in 2 years across 3 juntas. Very unstable regime at the time. In 1982, they came up with an idea, because there's nothing so unifying as having your country at war. So Argentina saw a great opportunity to go to war, and that was why they tried to seize the Falkland Islands back from Great Britain as an attempt to retain internal popularity for the junta. That was unsuccessful because they hadn't reckoned with the aforementioned Margaret Thatcher. By 1983, the junta saw the writing on the wall and realised that they needed to hold elections. And that led to the restoration of democracy in Argentina. And by 1985, the trial of the juntas had led to Videla being sentenced to 5 years in prison. He was subsequently pardoned. This was subsequently overturned. There was a lot of going backwards and forwards. One Argentinian approach was to say we need to draw a line under the past and we need to move forward, and that was at one stage called the 1986 full stop law. But there were still so many mothers who had their children taken away. There were still so many victims of the regime and their families who wanted to see justice done. In 2010, Videla was on trial for human rights violations. He did admit responsibility, but there was no remorse. His approach was that as many Argentinians as need to die to make it a stable state will die. He was convicted, sentenced to life in prison. He was 85 at the time. In 2012, he faced trial again for being involved in the baby stealing, the abduction of children that we spoke about before, and he was convicted to a further 50 years in prison. He died in prison in May 2013. So it's interesting that Pinochet never went to trial, but Videla did and ended up in prison. Not too many of our dictators have ended up going through a trial process or being sentenced to prison. So, Scott, you know I love a good obituary quote. The Washington Post in 2013, upon hearing about Videla's death, referred to him as, quote, the remorseless Argentinian army commander who came to power in a coup that launched the most barbaric period of the country's modern history. including thousands of extrajudicial killings and kidnappings. Went on to describe him as being skeletal in appearance and outwardly colourless, except for a prominent moustache. A wily, ruthless player in the military dictatorship's reign of institutionalised terrorism. The BBC had this to say about Vidya, remembering that they're writing this just 30 years after the Falklands War, that he was a symbol of a whole era of coups, military rule and fierce repression in South America. Under his regime, an estimated 30,000 political opponents were rounded up and killed in what became known as the Dirty War.
It's going to be hard to split these two. We've got to make a decision. Who will make it through our knockout competition?
I think Vidya is the biggest, baddest, meanest, not just because he was in power for a short time, which ironically overlaps with Pol Pot's regime, but what Vidya was able to achieve in a short space of time, and then that same regime decided that it would be a good idea to start a war in order to try and stay in power at domestic level. The stealing of the children, they're both horrible, but I think Vidya is the worst of the two. It's very close.
Yeah, the baby snatching. Baby snatching gets you over the line.
Look, it is very close. They're both pretty hideous.
Congratulations to Jorge Vidya. You have defeated Augusto Pinochet. Jorge Vidya remains in the contest to be named history's biggest dictator. Next week, no dictators next week. Next week, we're doing a bit of a roundup, covering a bit of everything. Who had the best quote? Who killed the most people? Who played the accordion and trapped people in a room and forced them to listen and dance to it?
Of the people we've covered so far, a bit of a look back at our first 10 episodes. Have we identified any common themes? Have we identified any particular traits of dictators? In a couple of episodes, we've looked at how many boxes each dictator can tick. So we might measure some of the dictators that we've covered against our dictator bingo list.
The draw is not yet finalised, so if you want to email me dictator, email it to libertydiespodcast@gmail.com. And you can find us on Twitter at libertydiespod. Anybody listening to this on Spotify, Apple Music, please rate the podcast 5 stars. If you're not going to rate it 5 stars, please don't bother. We'll see you next time. Thank you, Uncle Ian.
Thank you, Scott.